Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Is there a problem? I think that we all acknowledge there is. Is this a solution? I think it is. Is it the perfect solution? No, it's not.
The State House passes legislation to tighten residency requirements for hunting and fishing licenses. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 30th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, leaders from the North Slope village of Nuiqsip sue the federal government over changes to the Willow Project.
We're fighting to protect the area and think about the caribou.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
The U.S. Senate today passed a bill funding the Departments of Defense, Health, Labor, and Transportation, among others. But tonight, at 8 Alaska time, funding will lapse for much of the government. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin has more on yet another impending federal government shutdown.
It took a day longer than expected, but the Senate passed a major funding bill with both Alaska senators voting yes. That sends it to the House. But House members don't return to the Capitol until Monday. The shutdown or lapse in funding could last just one weekday. That would be minimal compared to the 43-day shutdown in 2025, the longest in U.S. history. Still, the Office of Management and Budget says it will follow its usual shutdown practices. That means, unless they're told otherwise, all federal employees who would normally report to work on Monday should still go. It's standard practice on the first weekday after a funding lapse for federal workers to be on duty to launch the orderly shutdown procedures. Then, if the shutdown continues, agencies are expected to notify their employees if they are essential and have to come to work or if they will be put on furlough. This time, the impact on Alaskans will be more limited than the shutdown last fall because Congress has already funded many of the departments for the rest of the fiscal year. Those include NOAA and the Departments of Commerce, Interior, Justice, and Veterans Affairs. Democrats held up a funding bill for the Department of Homeland Security. They demanded reforms to curb the kind of harsh immigration enforcement tactics deployed in Minneapolis, where agents shot and killed 2 U.S. citizens. Now, Congress and the White House have 2 weeks to reach an agreement on what those reforms will be. Both of Alaska's senators say they support some types of reform. Reporting from the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Alaska House of Representatives passed a bill today that would tighten residency requirements for Alaskans buying hunting or fishing licenses. House Bill 93 aims to ensure that only people who spend enough time each year in Alaska to qualify for a permanent fund dividend can buy resident licenses. Those tend to cost less money and offer higher bag limits than non-resident licenses. State law currently limits resident licenses to people who are physically present in Alaska with no plans to leave, do not claim residency in another state, and have maintained a home in the state for 12 consecutive months. But it does not require that resident hunters actually live in the state for a full year. Representative Rebecca Himshut, a Sitka independent who sponsored the bill, says that definition leaves a big loophole.
The last point means that we allow someone who rents a room in a home from friends, or someone who has a liveaboard boat that's on a trailer, but actually is in the state for less than a month, less than 2 months, potentially less than a week, to hunt and fish and enjoy the higher bag limits that are reserved for residents who are here year-round, shoveling snow, volunteering in their communities, and putting their kids in our schools.
Himshut's bill seeks to close that loophole. Alaskans would have to be physically present in the state for at least 180 days each year to get resident licenses. There would still be numerous exemptions, including for military service members, students, and others allowed to be outside the state and are still eligible for permanent fund dividends. People who do not qualify for a resident license would have the option to buy a non-resident license instead. A wide range of fish and game advisory committees, tribes, and local governments spread across the state backed the bill. Some 12 House Republicans opposed the bill, including Big Lake Republican Representative Kevin McCabe. He says he's concerned the bill would exclude some Alaskans from the benefits of a resident license.
What about those pilots that have vacation homes elsewhere that would like to go spend 2 months in Hawaii, say? And then they have to fly out of state for 15 days a month.
But the bill had broad support and passed with a bipartisan two-thirds majority in favor. Here's Representative Dan Sadler, an Eagle River Republican who caucuses with the minority.
Is there a problem? I think that we all acknowledge there is. Is this a solution? I think it is. Is it the perfect solution? No, it's not. But we don't deal in perfect and ideal. We do what's best and what we can do.
The bill now heads to the Senate, which passed a similar bill in 2024. Leaders of the North Slope village of New Ixit sued the U.S. Department of Interior this week for canceling a key subsistence protection for the Willow Project. Alyona Nidzin reports for the Alaska Desk.
About a year ago, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management issued an agreement with New Ixit leaders that prohibited oil and gas development around Teshekpuk Lake, which is located in the northeastern corner of the Natural Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The goal was to mitigate the harm that the ConocoPhillips Willow Project would have on caribou, a crucial subsistence resource for New Ixit residents. But last month, the Department of the Interior, which oversees BLM, canceled that agreement, saying it was improperly issued in the first place. In turn, New Ixit's leadership filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, arguing that the cancellation was illegal.
We're fighting to protect the area and think about the caribou.
George Tukak-Sailak is the president of New Ixit's Kupik Corporation. He says the cancellation was disappointing and damaged the trust of New Ixit residents.
By pulling that right away off, it's just like they're throwing us away. Not listening to the community.
Department of Interior officials declined to comment, citing the pending litigation. When BLM approved the controversial Willow Project in 2023, one condition was mitigating the harm on Teshekpuk Lake, a key habitat for the Teshekpuk caribou herd. And BLM signed a right-of-way agreement with New Ixit to meet that condition. That conservation measure was backed by the law that directs the Department of Interior to conduct oil and gas leasing in the reserve. The law also requires maximum protection for Teshekpuk Lake and other significant subsistence areas. Sailak with Kupik Corporation says that New Ixit residents are careful when they consider development projects so close to their home. But the promise of additional protections for caribou helped more residents to get on board with Willow.
We will support development in our area as long as we kind of work together to balance such as what we're doing here with a right-of-way.
But the Department of Interior said that the federal law does not authorize such conservation measures when it canceled the right-of-way agreement. The department also said in its cancellation letter that right-of-way agreements are usually used to allow oil and gas activities, not prohibit them. And that the primary goal of the law regulating the reserve is to support oil and gas leasing, while subsistence protections come second. The department indicated that they expect to hold lease sales this winter, which may include the area around Teshekpuk Lake. New Ixit leadership says they might consider legal avenues, like seeking injunctive relief, to protect the area, but no decision has been made yet. In Anchorage, I am Alyona Nidzin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the last musher to finish the Kuskokwim 300 reflects on his rookie race.
I was just sitting there for a while thinking, and I didn't come this far to, give up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
A Kotzebue man found in a remote cabin Tuesday suffering from extreme hypothermia later died from his injuries. According to Alaska State Troopers, 61-year-old Clifford Melton left Kotzebue on Monday, headed for the Northwest Arctic community of Buckland, about 70 miles away. Search and rescue teams from Buckland and Kotzebue responded after reports that Melton was overdue. Troopers located Melton about 35 miles from Kotzebue in an abandoned cabin and used a small plane with skis to transport him to Kotzebue and then Anchorage, where he died from his injuries. A trooper spokesperson said in an email that Melton routinely traveled from Kotzebue to Buckland and that his snow machine likely ran out of gas. Anchorage saw a record amount of snow in January, but that doesn't necessarily mean you need to shovel your roof just yet. Greg Soleil is in charge of building code for the municipality, and he says the snow load on roofs in the Anchorage area is about halfway to capacity. He says it's all about the weight of the snow. The municipality just took a measurement on Wednesday.
So we basically just have a device that is 1 square foot in area. We then shove that into the snow that's on the roof and then slip something underneath it, pull it up, and then dump that into a sack and then weigh that.
Since the 60s, municipal code has required roofs in the Anchorage Bowl to withstand 40 pounds of snow per square foot of roof. Soleil says right now the city is at about 20. In the past few years, Anchorage has recorded 24 commercial roof collapses, almost all with the same style of wooden trusses. Soleil says there have been no reported residential roof failures. He says homes are generally at much lower risk because of how they're built.
You know, residential construction, there's interior walls, that are also load-bearing, so that reduces the spans. There's more steeper pitch generally, so they shed snow.
Soleil says city officials will put out warnings if the snow load gets close to the max. Concerned residents can also keep an eye on total snowfall in the area. Right now, the city's at about 57 inches. If Anchorage gets up to 90 to 100 inches of snow, it might be a good time to clear your roof. There can also be warning signs inside your home.
There are other things that you can look for, like windows and doors that might be sticking or jamming, not opening correctly the way they usually do. Cracks in the drywall, that sort of thing.
The National Weather Service is forecasting a slight chance of rain and snow showers in the Anchorage area this evening. Meanwhile, salmon bycatch has been a flashpoint for years. Now, the group that oversees Alaska's federal fishing grounds is finally expected to make a decision regarding chum bycatch in the trawl fishery at its upcoming February meeting. KUCB's Theo Greenlee reports that un-Alaska leaders worried the decision could threaten the pollock industry that underpins the island's economy.
The Unalaska City Council took up the issue of salmon bycatch at its 2 January meetings, ultimately agreeing to support industry-run bycatch avoidance programs. City Fisheries consultant Frank Kelty warned council members that proposed limits could have major consequences for the community.
This is one of the most important items in the last few years.
Regulators are weighing whether to impose stricter limits on chum salmon bycatch in the pollock fishery. The decision will be made next month by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which oversees federal fisheries in the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands. Kelty told council members that the pollock bee season, which accounts for about 60% of the annual pollock harvest, is particularly at risk. He pointed to one proposal that would cap incidental catch of chum at 100,000 fish. Kelty said under that scenario, the pollock bee season would have shut down early in 11 of the past 12 years. That, he said, would ripple through Unalaska's economy, affecting processors, harvesters, city revenues, and support businesses.
As you know, the politics of bycatch have been front and center in the state for many years.
Trawl boats use large nets to scoop up a specific species of fish, but they often catch other types of fish, called bycatch. It's been a hot-button issue for decades and taken on new urgency as salmon returns to western Alaska rivers have collapsed in recent years. Runs on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers have reached crisis levels, forcing repeated closures of subsistence fisheries that native communities depend on for food. At the same time, the Bering Sea pollock fleet continues to catch, and often discard, chum salmon as bycatch. In some years, the fleet has caught more chum salmon than subsistence users along the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers are allowed to harvest, fueling anger and frustration. But genetic testing indicates that only a portion of chum salmon caught as bycatch originates from those western Alaska rivers, while most comes from hatchery fish from Asia or stocks from outside the region, including the Gulf of Alaska and Pacific Northwest. Still, communities in western Alaska have argued that controlling bycatch is the simplest fix for a complex problem. Kelty says it's important to have Unalaska's interests represented at the fishery meeting, where a large number of interest groups are expected to testify.
We're going to have a large amount of testimony at the North Pacific Council from many groups in western Alaska that would like to see strict alternatives placed on the pollock fishery, and I'm very concerned about that.
Caitlin Yeager is the executive director of the At-Sea Processors Association, an industry group that represents the catcher-processor fleet in the Bering Sea. She told Unalaska City Council members that the fleet is already making strides to reduce bycatch in areas where western Alaska chum bycatch is likely, and that hard caps on trawlers would be disastrous for processing communities like Unalaska.
And that means that vessels are tied up at the dock, our processing lines are empty, you have fewer deliveries, and this is an echoing shockwave throughout the community.
Yeager said the At-Sea Processors Association favors targeted tools like time and area closures and real-time genetic testing over hard caps. That's another suite of proposals under consideration by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council.
We need to maintain a degree of flexibility to adapt and continue these improvements without shutting down the fishery and shutting down coastal economies with it.
The Unalaska City Council ultimately passed a resolution that supports bycatch rules that don't shut down the fishery. The city will file its public testimony with the North Pacific Fishery Management Council ahead of the February meeting. Reporting from Portland, Oregon, I'm Theo Greenley.
December's winter storms in southeast Alaska damaged structures, including grow tunnels at a small-scale farm in Wrangell. The business is one of a few growers in Wrangell who supply the community with fresh produce and flowers. KSTK's Colette Zarnicki visited Ocean View Gardens to see exactly how much damage this winter caused them.
Wayne Ballou is giving me a tour of his farm. He's one of the owners of Ocean View Gardens. We're looking at four of the farm's grow tunnels, mostly with torn plastic hanging on the sides and no plastic on top. Dented and disjointed metal keep the structure of one tunnel standing. A couple months ago, there was no wreckage until the snow started falling.
One thing we will not grow this year, obviously, is corn on the cob. Because you do need the height in there. So there'll be no corn this year on the cob.
Ice crystals are everywhere, on the ground, on the structures, and on plants. The property is right next to the ocean and shows all the mountainous islands scattered in the archipelago.
Now the sun is just tall enough, it actually is going over reaching over the top of this mountain today. It'll get a little bit higher and we start warming up here pretty quick.
That will be good for the plants covered in frost and ice. Ballou says he missed the winter storm that damaged the tunnels. He and his wife were on a trip in New Hampshire, and they found out about the damage from a text on December 10th.
That small one over there, that one I was in the middle of building, and that one there, it crushed completely to the ground.
He says there were three layers of ice on the structures, along with a lot of snow weight from the storm. Since they're considered temporary buildings, insurance does not cover the damage, which he says cost the company tens of thousands of dollars.
It's bad, but you evolve and go move forward. It's just a little bit of a setback. I think out of it, we will actually have nicer tunnels to work in. They will be taller. And we'll move forward.
Because of the damage, Ballou expects they'll have a different growing year. He says many of the plants will be grown outside and they'll build much smaller hoop tunnels as they plant. That should protect and support them this season.
Things might be a little later for everyone. We'll see how things go, but using the hoop tunnels, you can pretty much mimic the large tunnels. It'll just be a little bit more work on our part.
He's not too worried since there's still other tunnels and a heated greenhouse that's holding strong.
Let's see if it's froze. Nope. So this is our purchased greenhouse that we used last year. This has been up a little over a year now. None of the spring crops will be interrupted. The hanging baskets and all the trays of flowers and everything go in this one. And that one there, I have the materials will be here. In fact, they might already be here for that one. So that one's going to be erected here in the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Ballou says even with the damage, they're expanding their business. They'll have about 650 hanging baskets, vegetable starts, and more than 200 trees and shrubs. A lot of Wrangellites look forward to the hanging baskets since a supplier down south stopped providing them.
Doesn't seem like anyone else has really filled that gap except for us.
He says they plan to also sell in neighboring Petersburg next season, too. In Wrangell, I'm Colette Zarnicki.
The Kuskokwim 300 Red Lantern Award, given to the last place finisher, is meant to honor perseverance in the sled dog sport. It's a word fitting for the story of a 17-year-old musher's first ever 300-mile race. KYUK's Samantha Watson reports.
Charlie Chingliak needed special permission to run the K300 alongside the adults. Those adults are mostly professionals. Iditarod champs who run dogs full-time or as part of sled dog tour businesses. And they're mostly not from the YK Delta.
But Chingliak is growing up just upriver from the start line.
He's a high school student from Akiachuk who fits the sport in around homework and basketball practice.
I had a game at 7, missed out to come to the banquet.
It was the teenager's first ever 300-mile race. And it was grueling. By the time he left the final checkpoint, Chingliak hadn't slept in nearly 3 days.
Yeah, I had a seat, so I was just sitting on the seat. Like, I tied a rope around my hand, so if I fall off, they just drag me.
But he kept going. And as most of the teams passed the finish line, a lot of people tuned in online to track Chingliak's progress through a GPS tracker on the K300 website. But about 13 miles from the finish line, that GPS tracker stopped moving.
And out of nowhere behind Akiachuk, one dog just, like, it was done. I was tired also.
Charlie and his dog hit a wall. While he was stopped there, trying to figure out what to do, Chingliak got a text from champion and Bethel musher Pete Kaiser, who had crossed the finish line hours earlier and won the race. Kaiser asked him about the dog and gave him some advice. The veteran musher told him, when you can't keep going and you don't want to scratch, there's a third option. You can take a break.
Yeah, they were telling me to take my time. And so I was just sitting there for a while thinking, and I didn't come this far to, like, give up.
Chingliak says he fed his dogs and decided to camp out on the trail. He huddled on the sled, curled up in his sleeping bag. Alone on the tundra, in near-zero temps, the young musher got his first sleep of the race. Charlie's family was parked on the ice road watching for him. His dad, Jeff Chingliak, says about 4 hours after Charlie's tracker had stopped, he checked again.
It was moving.
he looked off into the distance, and there was Charlie's headlight moving closer.
My wife woke up and she's like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Look to your side." "Oh, is that Charlie?"
Letting the dogs rest had worked.
That dog just got up and started moving around, started being himself, and that's when I knew it was ready to get up and finish.
His dad says all of a sudden, the world came back into motion. He says a line of cars appeared behind him, coming from Akiachuk. Apparently, other people from home had been staying up, watching the tracker. At the finish line, it is 2 a.m, and yet a line of trucks is parked along the chute, and a small crowd has formed. Among them are Charlie's family, but he's also met by all these YK Delta mushers. Charlie's dad said it surprised even him. He thought everybody would be sleeping.
So emotional, I was just trying not to cry, and you know, it was just happy tears.
It's a moment bursting with glory, but for Charlie, it was about his team.
Yep, I'm very proud of those dogs. I was like just happy to finish and pack the dogs up and go home and sleep.
At the Mushers banquet, Chingliak is named Rookie of the Year. He is also given the Red Lantern Award. In sled dog race tradition, it's given to the last place finisher in honor of the perseverance it takes to see a race through.
Taking home $3,600, the only rookie in this year's race.
The pride in the room is palpable.
From Akiachuk, Charlie Chingliak.
In Bethel, I'm Samantha Watson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Eric Stone in Juneau, Aliona Neidzin and Hannah Floor in Anchorage, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, Theo Greenlee in Portland, Oregon, Colette Zarnicki in Wrangell, and Samantha Watson in Bethel. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde. Kirsten Dobroth is our producer. And I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.